are listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mary Roach is a science writer with a sharp wit who has written about some touchy subjects like death and the afterlife. Now she's tackled a subject that makes some people feel even more uneasy, sex. Her latest book is called Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Sex and Science. It's published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mary Roach back to the show.
Hooray!
Was sex a logical follow-up to death and the afterlife?
Well, for me it was. I just felt as though, you know, stiff was it was bodies in a lab. You know, now we've got warm bodies instead of cold bodies, so it didn't feel like too much of a leap for me.
Do you think writing about taboo subjects makes it easier to be funny?
I do think so. I think you're diffusing the unease, and yeah, I think it does.
And would you choose a subject if you didn't find much humor in it?
No. I leave that for people who are much better at that. Yeah.
In this case, you're looking at sex research. Is most of it pretty funny?
No. Most of it is quite dry. I'm like a huge filtration system. I go through scads of journals and books, and then I get to this moment where I'll find, for example, my favorite line in Kinsey's work: cheese crumbs spread in front of a pair of copulating rats will distract the female but not the male. And I think, That's why I do what I do. This is what I do, yes.
Was he the start?
No, he was not. He got interested in sex or sex research by speaking with a man named Robert Latou Dickinson, who was a gynecologist in the 1890s and 1920s, and he had a practice in Brooklyn Heights, and he was really the first to not only to start doing intimate interviews one-on-one with patients, he also got interested in the biomechanics of intercourse, and actually he debunked a popular theory which was called coital interlocking, and he was the first to actually take a look inside and
see how that was impossible.
It's not working, yeah, not happening.
Although it continues to be the subject of jokes at boys' camps, I have to tell you. At least it was when I was a kid. Dr. Dickinson...
I'd like to hear more about that.
It was just because we were ignorant. Dr. Dickinson found that 18 women throughout his years of practice were still virgins, even though they thought that they had had sexual intercourse.
That's right.
How's that possible?
The men weren't going any further than the cleft of the vulva, the outer labia, which they would go in about an inch and a half, and they'd hit some resistance, and they'd stop there, and they thought they were doing it. And because there was so little material to read, and there was very little conversation about sex, no one knew. Women didn't know they had to spread their legs. I mean, there were just basic things people didn't understand.
So this is the Victorian age when people didn't talk about these things, or at least polite
yes.
people didn't talk about these things in polite society, or even to their spouses.
Exactly, yeah, or their doctors.
When did that change? Have there been times when people have been more open than others?
The 1920s was actually a very open time. There were marriage manuals back then that were quite explicit, that would talk about the clitoris and how important that was in women's pleasure. They were suggestions for alternative positions to the missionary position. So the 20s were really quite a freewheeling age compared to the 30s, 40s, and 50s. It was a good time to be a woman.
Where are we now?
I think we're split along the lines that the country is split. There's more sex than ever in the media, but there's also stronger voices from conservatives, and it's difficult for sex researchers, partly because of the internet. Conservative groups can do a subject word search and locate studies that have to do with sex and pinpoint them.
I got some material from one of my producers on this, and when she sent it under Bonk, it went into our junk mail filter.
Yeah.
When she sent it as Mary Roach, everything was okay.
Yeah, there were times when I would receive mail when I was working on this book, and it would say the subject line would lead me to not be sure if it was spam or something from one of my researcher friends.
Hasn't it been hard to fund sex studies?
It is hard to fund with sex studies today, with the exception of the current rush for the holy grail of the pharmaceutical companies, which would be some sort of drug to raise women's libidos.
That's so kind of, a female Viagra.
Essentially, only not dealing with the – I mean, it's essentially, yes.
So if I were a researcher who was interested in doing other things along these lines, and there's just as much mystery about how we are sexually as how our brains work and a whole bunch of other areas of our bodies that we'd like mm-hmm. to know a lot more about – would I be unlikely to get any funding unless I was working for a pharmaceutical?
It would be a real challenge. There's Roy Levin is one of the greatest sex physiology researchers. He's retired, but I visited with him, and he said, if there's not a practical application for it, if there's not something to give the patients, then you're not going to get any money for it.
Then there's also the matter of doing studies on animals, other animals. Can we make analogies? For example, most animals have limited periods of sexual activity when the female is in estrus. But
right.
That's not true with humans and bonobos and only a few other animals.
Right. There's very limited things you can conclude from watching or from studying animals having sex. Kinsey originally, he went on a famous road trip where he basically shot a lot of stag film of animals mating, and he documented some interesting things such as homosexual couplings. And but the thing with animals, it's over so quickly, and what can you really learn? And so it's not a very fruitful area for studying human sexual physiology.
In recent years, it's many people have re-evaluated Kinsey's work and thought that it was kind of skewed at times because he was looking for certain things and he wanted to make certain points. That could be a problem in any sex research.
Sure. Well that's specifically Kinsey's Kinsey's survey work, and he was trying to document the whole spectrum of sexual behavior, and in essence to say all of this is normal. The chapter of his work that I looked at was his physiological work, where he actually had couples up in, he didn't have a lab for it like Masters and Johnson would do 10 years later. He was up in the attic and was filming sexual couplings up there. And he, in that case, it was just straight documentation of the physiology of arousal and orgasm. So that was pretty, straightforward. But
today we can do it with all sorts of electrodes attached to the brain. Are we learning more, or are people not doing that because they can't get funding?
Well, they're learning. Yeah, there are now, for example, there's someone studying. You can use MRI to study, the clitoris. Without MRI, the clitoris appears to be just, a very small, little bean there. And but in fact, 90% of it is below deck. So it's, that some of the new technology has enabled studies to be done that, that are shedding light on things that we wouldn't think.
My guest is Mary Roach, whose latest book is called Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. It's published by Norton. In one case, you discuss a study that linked fertility increase to sexual stimulation when pigs were inseminated in Denmark. In that case, the farmers wind up being the scientists. I'm not sure
yes.
they were happy with that.
No, they were a little uncomfortable with that. Yeah, the Danish Pork Production Board figured out that if you sexually stimulate the sow while you're inseminating her, you'll end up with a 6% increase in your farrowing rates, which means more piglets. And that's based on this theory called upsuck, which
mm-hmm. is... Does that work with humans as well? Has it been determined whether female orgasm serves a purpose beyond pleasure?
That's an area that I was kind of surprised that is still a question. Masters and Johnson did a very elaborate and amazing study trying to document upsuck. They actually were skeptics of upsuck, and they weren't able to document. I won't go into the gory details.
I appreciate that. The FCC appreciates that.
Anyway, it's something. I talked to fertility experts today, and I said, do you ever counsel people about the role of orgasm in conception, and is that something you think plays a role? And they said, I've been doing fertility for the past 30 years, and I can't answer that question. We don't know the answer. And that was kind of amazing to me.
So has science in this area been focused mostly on functionality?
Well, right now it's focused mostly on on sexual dysfunction and that and not so much on the pure physiology. I had to go all the way to Egypt. There was a researcher who he passed away this past October, but he was one of the few who was he studies reflexes of the pelvic floor muscles and all these different things that are going on without unbeknownst to you when you're having sex.
That's Dr. Ahmed Shafiq?
Yes.
Actually, that is one of the more hilarious sections of the book, his experiments.
One in particular, yeah.
You want to talk about that?
I would love to. I came across this. It's a study was in, I believe it was a European Journal of Urology. And he was looking at the effect of wearing of polyester on sperm count and also sexual activity. And I'm just kind of flipping through in a daze. And then I turn the page and I see that, in fact, he's made little tiny polyester pants for the rats. And there's a drawing, this lovely line drawing that says figure one, the underpant worn by the rat. And there's a little hole for the tail and a little drawstring. And lo and behold, the polyester, probably by raising the temperature, lowered sperm count. So there you go.
It works. So polyester is, if you want to be able to have a child, you should not wear polyester underwear.
And the other direction, he actually was advocating these little polyester, they weren't exactly underwear. There's little pouches that men would wear as birth control.
He's written over 1,000 journal articles on various studies, many having to do with urology and sex. How does that happen in a country that has a strong, what word do I want to use, where many people feel that even going out in the street, a woman going out in the street unveiled.
Right,
is,
very morally conservative, and more so now than when he started doing his research. He said quite openly, he said, I pay women, I pay prostitutes, because that's the only way I could do my work. And so...
Is that where some of these studies are being done with prostitutes and brothels?
In Cairo, yes. Here, no. Although Masters and Johnson, for their enormous project on human sexual response, their beta test, as it were, was a group of prostitutes. They sort of worked out what they were going to do and how they were going to do it using a group of prostitutes. They didn't then include them in the sample, but they did start out with them.
Has their work held up over the years?
Their work, it has held up, although the model for human sexual response has been, the plateau phase has been called into question. I mean, so there are people who have sort of little niggling disagreements with them, but for the most part, yes.
What happens when something like Viagra comes along and there are all of these different reasons given for things like impotence in different cultures? Does a culture just have to do a complete turnaround?
You know, it was interesting. I asked one a urologist. I said, you know, in the case of someone who comes in who's 20s or 30s and probably nothing wrong with his erectile tissue, why are you giving him Viagra when it's probably something more psychological? And he said, well, we start with Viagra because impotence in itself creates this anxiety and it's a vicious cycle and we want to take that away. And then we ask them to go to therapy as well, but it can actually help sort of reverse that cycle.
Since Viagra affects blood flow, you would assume, and many people did, that it would work with women just as well as it works with men. Has anybody come up with a reason why it hasn't?
Sure, because what Viagra does is it inhibits the substance that causes the erection to go away. So it helps. It's very good at helping you keep an erection longer. But increasing blood flow in women, I mean, since women don't need erections, really, at most, you're just going to get sort of a localized warmth, sensation of warmth. You're not going to, with men, you're giving them a mechanical boost.
But it wouldn't be the same with a clitoris?
Because the woman, most women go to a sexual dysfunction clinic because they don't feel that their libido is too low or they're not enjoying sex. And just a little bit of increase in blood flow doesn't do the trick for them.
You give advice on common issues involving sex. You think that people still don't know very much?
I think people know as much as, I think... we know more than anybody has in the past. Doesn't mean we know everything, but I think we're pretty well educated.
I just read the other day that only half the women checked out have G-spots. Now, I remember when the G-spot was the big thing, and everybody was concerned that they weren't always
right
stimulating the G-spot. Now it turns out only half women have G-spot, although I can't figure out how that would work out. Pretty much the same.
Yeah, the G-spot, there's been there's not a lot of argument as to whether there's an erogenous area somewhere on the front wall of the vagina. But as for a specific spot with a structure that is a different tissue, you know, a discrete structure, there's still people arguing back and forth about that. So,
well, now you've written Stiff, which is about death, and also Spook, which is about the afterlife, and Bonk, which is about sex and sexual research. What comes next? You going to find another word that will simulate a book? Because you got to need another one-word title, or are you going to look for something that we also consider taboo that you can kind of make fun of?
I've kind of run out of taboos. What's left, Leonard? What's left? I'm stuck.
I could probably think of them a few, but I'm not going to talk about them on the air.
Well, if people
call Elliot Spitzer and find out what he has to say. Yeah. A listener, before you go, a listener asked why female ejaculation isn't really talked about. Her gynecologist didn't know anything about it.
Well, if you go on the internet, it is talked about quite a bit.
So the internet is taking care of all of those doctors who don't know anything, the male gynecologists?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of good information on the internet. Female ejaculation, there was a... an argument goes back and forth. Well, it's just urine, and if you go, there's certain pornographic sites where women are just spurting urine for sure. But there have been tests done. For example, you give a woman a dye that will show up and dye her urine, and then you look at essentially the wet spot, and it's not blue.
Oh, so okay. There is research being done on important things.
There is research. Oh yes, there is. Oh yeah, it's all in Bonk.
Mary Roach's latest book is called Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. It's published by Norton. Thank you so much. I'm not going to ask you what you're doing next because I kind of hinted and you didn't give me an answer and now I'm afraid.
It's not what you think.
Okay, good. Mary Roach will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Tribeca Barnes & Noble store. That's at Warren and Greenwich Streets. Up next, the Kurds are the world's largest ethnic group without a country of their own. We'll hear about their ongoing struggle for statehood and how it has shaped Middle Eastern politics.